It's my pleasure to bring to you this special exhibition tour on our exhibition entitled Udry's Painted Menagerie. And as you'll see from the banners that have been around the Getty Center and also around Los Angeles, the entire show is really dedicated to animals. We're going to see lots of animals today. And so I'll give you an overview of the exhibition in this space. And I really want this to be a nice dialogue because we are a small group. If you have any questions or want to know a little more about something, don't hesitate to ask. Again, my name is Brian. And I really hope it's an enjoyable experience. This is a very unique exhibition for us here at the Getty. And I'll explain why once we get upstairs. I think I would start off by showing this reproduction of a portrait done of the artist Jean-Baptiste Udry by the French artist Pirano, the actual painting you can see today in the Louvre Museum. But if we come a bit closer here, this is the gentleman whose artwork we're going to be considering today for the majority of the tour. He was the court painter to King Louis XV, so in the 18th century this is where we're located historically. And he's primarily known for his portraits of animals. Though he was trained as a portrait of people, he makes his fame through his animal portraits. And what I love about this portrait here is that you can see in the background a sketch, something he's begun working on, one of these animals. And the animal in the distance there is meant to be a dog. And we'll see some of his sketches later on in the exhibition. Now, in terms, again, of the title, it's Udry's Painted Menagerie. So the last part of the title introduces the idea of the menagerie, which was a collection of exotic animals that was begun by Louis XIV, just prior to Louis XV. And so at his grand palace of Versailles, he has beautiful animals brought in from all over the world as diplomatic gifts, and also examples of this idea of trade, of exploration that was going on at the time. And so we're going to approach the exhibition backwards. It's set up in three rooms. The first room has a series of paintings that we'll come to at the end, a middle room with drawings, and then the final space with some decorative objects and some interesting stories that occur about one animal, stories related to one specific creature. And as we pass just past this wall here, I'll mention that there is a film that documents some of the conservation effort that was done on two of the paintings that you'll see today. And this introduces the idea that this exhibition is special and unique in that it sort of was begun, the catalyst for it was a conservation project, which is somewhat unique for an exhibition to really focus on conservation as the primary element of the exhibition. And so we'll come to that idea of conservation again at the end, but I wanted to introduce it here just so that you can come back later today. Now, what's interesting about this show as well is that it might be difficult for a contemporary audience to get into portraits of animals. There's not much going on. There's not blood and violence. But in many ways, I think we can connect with these paintings. Even though they are from about 250 to 300 years ago, we can still connect to them today. And so hopefully we'll make those connections today. And by entering into the last room, we really approach one animal who at this time attained celebrity status. And again, this might be somewhat difficult for us to relate to today, but hopefully by the end of our discussion today, you'll see really why that was, that this one animal became so famous, and just the way animals were received in the courts of Europe. And we're going to walk to the far end of this room. And just by looking around these first couple galleries, you'll get a sense that the animal that I'm referring to is a rhinoceros. And so if you would all join me on this back wall. Now today we all have the luxury in any large city, major city around the world, to take a short trip to a zoo to see animals from all over the world. Sort of a luxury today. But back in the 1700s, 1800s, and back in history, they didn't have that luxury. Many people in Europe wouldn't have traveled very far outside of their homes, except for those that were exploring the world. And so I'd like to introduce this woodblock print. This is done by the German artist Albrecht Dürer, and it's depicting a rhinoceros. And what's specifically interesting about this rhinoceros is that we know that a male rhinoceros arrived in Europe in the year 1515, as you can see on the date in the woodblock. And previous to this, there had only been about six living rhinos on the European continent at the time. So this would have been a very rare sight for people to see. Had anyone been to the medieval beast exhibition today, the manuscript show? If you go to that exhibition, you can look at manuscripts from the Middle Ages and see how people depicted these sort of fantastic creatures, creatures that many of them had never seen. And at the time, they felt that animals like the rhinoceros and the elephant, for example, lived on the far corners of the world in India and in Africa, the far reaches of Africa. So these animals were not as common. They weren't as common as the livestock that you would find around Europe, for example. So when this rhinoceros arrived, it arrived in Portugal in 1515. And it came from India originally. And you can identify an Indian rhinoceros primarily because of the single horn. The African rhino will have two, exactly. And you also notice that beautiful plated armor and the bumps on the skin. And so coming in and looking closer, when the rhinoceros arrived, the idea was that a group of animals, a menagerie, was going to be sent to the Pope by the Portuguese king, wanting to win favor with the king of Portugal, the Pope. But on the journey, this rhinoceros was sent to Rome. And on the way, the ship sank and the rhino died. And so word of this rhinoceros reached Albrecht Dürer in Germany. He had never seen the rhinoceros, never seen one in his lifetime. And he creates this image of what he interpreted a rhinoceros to look like. So you get this sense that it's very strange looking to where we might think of a rhinoceros today. And yet this was the image that became the standardized view of a rhinoceros up until the time of the artist Oudry. And we'll talk more about why that was in just a moment. And just to drive that point home, again, this is created in the year 1515. And if you look just next to it in this book, you can see the very same image in reverse of Dürer's rhinoceros. And driving that home even further, if you turn just around in that large case in the center of the room, you'll see one of my favorite specimens in the exhibition. This is a rhinoceros created by the German artist Johann Gottlieb Kirchner, and it's created in the year 1731. So we've moved forward about 200 years since Albrecht Dürer's woodblock print. And you get the sense that that image has circulated throughout Europe and is still accepted, even in the 1700s, of what a rhinoceros looked like. I'll mention that there's a great connection between this piece here and our permanent collection. This work is done in porcelain at the Meissen Porcelain Factory over in Germany, and it was created for Augustus the Strong, the Elector of Saxony. And instead of creating a living menagerie, which was somewhat expensive, he decided to create a porcelain menagerie. So you can head over into our south building and see two other specimens that would have been part of this menagerie. Yes. And yet it's so detailed, I mean, to the very fine detail that it's anatomically correct. It is a male rhinoceros, and I'll allow you to do your own examination of this creature at your own time. But also, if you read the German text above the Dürer woodblock print, it describes the rhinoceros as having skin the color of a toad. So I think it's very interesting the way that Kirchner here has given us that same skin tone. So showing really the influence that Albrecht Dürer's woodblock print had on the art world at the time. So as I said, up until this point, there hadn't been many rhinoceros present on the European continent. Now after that rhino in 1515, the next rhinoceros to come to the European continent came about 200 years later. And her name was Clara. And if we turn for a moment just to this series of prints, there's the sort of illustrate the story of her life. We know that she came from India, and you can see again the presence of the single horn in this engraving by Beck, a German artist. So she grew up in India in the city of Assam and was actually raised in a home of a wealthy individual, member of the Dutch East India Company, the trade company. She's very docile from a young age. People commented on how strange she was, polite at the table. She exhibited a set of manners. And yet when she outgrew the house, she ultimately came under the possession of a Dutch sea captain that you can see at the bottom here. His name is Dumont Vandermeer. And he takes Clara, the rhinoceros, on this 7-month journey around the Horn of Africa up into Europe. And from there, she begins about a 20-year grand tour, as it was referred to, this tour all around the major cities of Europe. And so again, this is where it might be difficult for a contemporary artist to realize how important and how miraculous this would have been to some. Because at this point, people knew of the image that Dürer had sort of begun of what a rhinoceros looked like. And yet for many people up until this point, they thought the rhinoceros was fully a mythical creature. And one example of that is if you're familiar with the explorer Marco Polo, when he travels over into the Eastern world, he comes across what he refers to as a unicorn. And yet he says that this unicorn looked so different than all of the descriptions that he'd heard about or seen in Europe. And so we think that oftentimes the rhinoceros is sort of confused with the unicorn, or that rather this is the animal that artists were talking about when they create that unicorn. You can see the presence of the single horn giving that away. And just to mention, this engraving here was sent as a sort of advertisement before Clara arrived in each city to sort of announce the presence of a living rhinoceros from India. Not only did he send these advertisements, but if we move two spaces down, you can come in and see some commemorative medals. They were made out of varying materials. We have one here in silver, the other in pewter with a copper core. The varying materials were meant for the varying audiences that would come to see Clara, so that many people could afford to have this sort of souvenir, capturing that moment of being able to say, I have seen Clara in the flesh, a living rhinoceros. Now, just out of curiosity, how many people here have actually seen a living rhinoceros? Is there anyone that hasn't? So anyone, again, that hasn't? So pretty much we all have, more or less. And we have to imagine that, again, at this time, it wasn't common for people to see a rhinoceros. And if we look just next to it, you can see Clara during one of her stops and how close the people come to Clara, the young boy in the pen, in this painting from the circle of Pietro Longhi, an Italian artist. And this is documenting a trip that she made to Venice over in Italy. And yet I think you'll notice that Clara might look a little bit strange here. If you look just on her nose, you can see that she's missing her horn. Now, a rhinoceros horn, if there's a clean cut, will grow back just like our fingernail. It's made out of keratin, so it has that same regrowth that will happen. And if you come in really close to this painting, you can actually see the horn is here on display. Anyone want to get closer to see it? I'll make it a little bit easier. It's right below the window on a small shelf. And so again, Clara was described as being very docile, this very friendly creature. And I love the way that people are so close to her, the way that this child sort of smiles in excitement, the way that this older gentleman with his wig takes his monocle to look and to examine, is this really here? Is this a living creature? Am I imagining this? And then the women off to the side here who appear to be posing for their own portrait, you know, looking out at the artist. And then you have another gentleman here. And what I love about this is it gives us a sense of what her life was like on a daily basis. You can see in the distance the cart that was used to travel her around Europe from city to city. And the young boy pours a bucket of water, and we know that she drank about 14 buckets of water a day. And then off to the side, you can see here the food that she ate. And as it says here, there were about 60 pounds of hay that she ate and 20 pounds of bread a day. Now, I'm no expert on rhinos, but I heard from a zookeeper at the Los Angeles Zoo that this combination of food is so unusual for a rhinoceros, and it's really amazing that she survived to live to be about 21 years old on that strange diet. And not only did she enjoy this diet of hay and bread, but they say that she became accustomed to orange rinds, tobacco smoke, and other, you know, strange things. It would be abnormal for her to eat. So this introduces that idea of Clara, the traveling rhinoceros. And the rest of this room, this last space, shows objects from decorative arts, a clock, shows wall screens, and show the way that Clara was incorporated into the decorative scheme of Europe. Now, before we look at any of those objects, I would like to just point out this painting here. You can see we've come a long way from our Albrecht Dürer wood block print to now this painting by Findorff, a German artist. And if you notice on the label, it says that it's after Jean-Baptiste Oudry, the artist who we'll be considering today. And so this is a copy of Oudry's portrait of Clara. Now, as we'll see in a moment, this is much smaller scale than the Clara portrait done by Oudry. And yet he renders the painting to such accuracy that they really are so similar. I hope that you'll make that comparison at some point today. Now, well, I'll just point out one object in this decorative section and ask that you all come back to it. And it's probably my favorite piece in this section. And it's a large wall panel. And as we approach the panel, you'll notice a map on the floor that shows the travels that Clara took. You can see everywhere that she went throughout Europe. So she was a very busy rhinoceros. But if we just come back to this wall panel for a moment, it's a beaded textile. And you'll notice an image of Clara now at the bottom. And it's strikingly similar to the version of Clara that we saw in that painting by the Circle of Pietro Longhi. And the reason I point this wall panel out is that you can also head back into our decorative art collection, and there's a beautiful tapestry that has a rhinoceros in it. And I'll let you be investigatory today and find out if it's Clara that's depicted or the Albrecht Dürer rhinoceros. So there is a great connection between these objects here in the exhibition and the permanent collection as well. Now, the artist that we're concerned with today is Jean-Baptiste Oudry, and at the heart of his artistic practice was drawing. And so the second room in the exhibition introduces Oudry as a draftsman, and drawing was very important to him. He guarded his drawings, had notebooks filled with his drawings, and many of the drawings were made from life studies of animals. And at this time, we have to remember in the 17th and 18th century, it was a time of great exploration, and also this idea of natural history. They wanted to document the living world, what the world was like, their habits, not so much in the fantastic, maybe medieval sense of animal behaviors as in the bestiaries of the Middle Ages, but in an accurate and scientific, reason-based description of the animals. So again, I think what's beautiful about this is you can imagine being in a home in the 17 and 1800s where you would basically view this object under candlelight. And it would be a very ambient setting, looking at this scene at night, and the bead itself, you can get a sense of it in this room, the way the light reflects off the beads, giving that sort of movement across the surface. I think it would be really a magical experience at evening. So we're going to pass into the next room, and just to give you a little preview of the next room, it's much darker than this space here, and a bit cooler. All the works that we'll see are done on paper. They're works on paper, and so for conservation reasons, we need to have the dim lighting and the cooler temperature. As I mentioned, Oudry was a great draftsman, and I hope that you'll get an appreciation for his working process before we see the animal portraits that were part of this menagerie series. And so here you see a work that's done, the Dutch rhinoceros, as you see it called here. This is Clara, the same rhinoceros we were talking about. And she's given many names. The Dutch rhinoceros, the Dutch portion of that name, refers to the Dutch sea captain that was her owner and chaperone, really, at the time. And so this work is created in the year 1749 to 1750, just after Clara had visited Paris at the Saint-Germain Fair. So we know that, again, she made this large journey, as you saw on the map, around Europe. And one of her destinations was Paris. Now, ultimately, Oudry has to part with these paintings that we'll look at in a moment. And so before doing so, it was commented that possibly this is a sort of a remembrance sketch that he does. He wanted to remember his experience with Clara, so he renders it with such detail. You can come in close and see the beautiful black charcoal and the white highlights across the surface here. Even down to the very small details, the large toenails that we'll see in the actual portrait in a moment. And if you come in even closer, there are some stray white markings here. So we get the sense that Oudry was possibly working out, getting a certain point on his chalk as he's working across the surface, wanting to get just the right thickness or the right size to create these beautiful shadings. So again, as I mentioned, he creates these beautiful animal portraits, but he originally begins with sketches. And he does these sketches from life. And so at this point, I'll just sort of introduce again that idea of the menagerie that was created under Louis XIV. And then under Louis XV, it was continued. But during Oudry's life, the chief surgeon to the king, his name was La Peyronie, wanted Oudry to create a suite of animal portraits, ultimately to be engraved for natural history texts. And ultimately, though, the surgeon dies before the completion of these works and before he pays for the objects. So like any good businessman, Oudry is very quick in his thinking and will sort of flesh the final end of this story out in the last room. But I'd like to look at a few more of his drawings before we approach the portraits. And just to give you a sense of his working method again, you notice from the Clara sketch, it was very detailed, very finished in its look on the blue paper. Here we have what is termed a study of male leopard and study of female leopard. And so I don't think it's too difficult. If you just spent some time looking at the two of them, I think you could decide which one is meant to be the male and which is meant to be the female. Maybe not as clear yet, but when we see the finished portraits, I think it will be more clear. And so you get a sense that Udri was in the menagerie one day watching these animals, always observant of their behavior and waiting for them to strike these sort of, you know, beautiful poses, maybe iconographic poses. You can see this of the female leopardess as she is sort of posed up on her legs here with a beautiful shading under her belly here. And then with the male leopard, you get a sense of the swoop of his body, the movement of his tail. And again, the idea that he was working very quickly on this sketch just to capture that initial movement of the animal. Now, along the back wall, you'll see some other animals in this menagerie. And many of the animals that came to the menagerie came by way of royal gifts. They were given as diplomatic gifts. And one of the animals that you won't be able to see in a full life-size painting is a tiger. As I mentioned, this exhibition sort of began as a conservation effort to conserve two of the paintings that we'll see. And another painting by Udri is of a tiger that is now in the laboratories at the Getty undergoing conservation as well. So I think we all look forward to the final moment when it will be revealed for all of us to see. But in this study of a reclining tiger in about 1740, you get a sense that he's tried to capture this moment of rest, of repose for the tiger here. And again, even clearer in this drawing, you get a sense of him testing out his chalk, getting, you know, these squiggles off to the side, these sort of, you know, abstracted markings that are really helping get a fine point for his chalk. Now we'll move down into this space. And you'll really get a sense by looking at these drawings, the attention that he pays to the anatomical features of these animals. And oftentimes you'll see animals in these combat scenes, these great struggles. And in this study, you see it's entitled Dog Attacking a Bittern, in which you see that Udri has gridded his paper. You see the grid pattern in this red. So that we think ultimately this would have been created on a larger surface. It would have ultimately created a full painting of this study. And so you can see how dramatic this scene is with the bird fleeing from the dog that has moved in to attack the creature. And we know that Udri gained fame in the French courts because of his scenes of the hunt, the royal hunt. It was always important to have a painter depict the royal hunt to sort of show off your might as a king. And so these paintings on this wall, or sketches rather, help give that idea of his preparatory working for these sort of hunt scenes. So again, this is the heart of the exhibition, and it is an intimate space. So I hope you'll come back into this space and really spend time with each of the drawings on their own. But as we pass out into the final room, which is really the bulk of this conservation effort and the exhibition, I would like to point out two smaller studies of dogs' heads. And I think you'll get a sense at this point that we've moved from sort of what looked to be quick sketches of animals in motion to now what are more finished sketches. And you get a sense of the tenderness that Udri has for these animals, the compassion, the sensitivity to not only, again, the anatomical details, but a sense of personality, a sense of the character of the animal underneath all of that fur and skin.
What did he use to catch the pose?
What did he use to catch the pose? No, absolutely, yeah. No, this is definitely pre-camera. So it comes from that close observation. And in fact, and the question was, if you didn't hear, was what did he use to capture these poses? And he gives a lecture before the academy in which he states that a great artist needs to spend time in nature observing, extensive time observing the world around them. It's only through extensive observation that we can truly create a finalized image. And so these would come from hours observing animals, taking these, you know, sort of typical positions. I'm sure he'd seen this type of position or this pose several times in the animal. And he may have begun by, you know, initial sketches as he did with that leopard, just to capture that impression of what they were doing. And then here you get these very finished images of the dogs. And I love this image specifically because you get a sense that you could look into the soul of that creature there, that it really has, you know, a soul and a life of its own. Certainly, I think in our mind today, we can look at this as being very photographic. He does certainly have that photorealism to even a sketch here, which I think is so fantastic. Now, not too unlike the Medieval Beast exhibition that I hope you'll go see, there are some drawings that Oudry does, over 200, to illustrate the fables of Jean de La Fontaine, in which he gives animals these sort of personalities and uses animals to tell a moral story. And so in the Middle Ages, as you'll see in the manuscript show, there's these bestiaries that give these fantastic stories about animals, of dragons and elephants and other strange creatures. And it's not too different here during the time of Oudry with these fables by Jean de La Fontaine teaching morals. And so you can come back, and they're very fun stories to read on the text there. I hope you'll come back to those. Now, walking into the next space, you'll notice a really impressive series of paintings. And again, just to mention that brief history that we said, the surgeon to King Louis XV, La Péronie, had requested of Oudry to create a series of portraits documenting some of the species in the royal menagerie. Again, many of which were brought as diplomatic gifts to the King of France. Now, something to note, Louis XV didn't take as much care of the menagerie as Louis XIV had. It had sort of gone into a state of decline, and yet in any case, we have a spectacular suite of paintings documenting many of the specimens in this series. And so I'll start off with the portrait of the lion. And it's really the lion and the portrait of Clara that we'll come to that sparked this conservation effort. It was back in the year 2001 when our conservator of paintings department, paintings and the head of the painting department, rather, were in the State Museums of Schwerin on a day-long quest to sort of look to see if there were any projects that required conservation. Conservation to a great degree that maybe wouldn't be able to be accomplished without another third party intervening. And so when they came to the end of their day, someone had mentioned, well, what about those two Oudry paintings down in storage? Well, the fact is that the portrait here of the lion and of Clara the rhinoceros had been in storage for about 150 years. So they hadn't been seen by the public up until the time that our curators and conservation department went to Schwerin. Now, you'll notice just briefly that the lights have turned on because the paintings are on the second floor of the majority of the buildings in the museum to allow natural lighting in. But when the natural lighting isn't enough, the artificial light does come on. And just to give you a sense of what I mean by this conservation of these images, there's an image in the catalog that shows what this painting of the lion looked like prior to the conservation effort. And it's quite spectacular to look at. So again, this is what the film will help illustrate, the working method of the conservators to restore this painting to the version that we see before us today. So you can imagine, if you look closely at the painting was folded in half, so you see the seam in the middle of the painting, and then rolled up. And it had been in storage again for about 150 years. So one of the unique opportunities of this exhibition is to see these portraits, not only for the first time in 150 years, but in context with the other portraits that are in that suite of paintings. So seeing them all together in one space is quite fantastic. There was another exhibition several years ago at Versailles, very appropriate location to present these portraits, as that was where the menagerie was. But the lion and Clara were here in the laboratory undergoing conservation. So this is really the first time in over 150 years that you're able to see the majority of these paintings together in one location. Now, something that I'll mention is that the lion was not part of the original commission by La Péronie, the surgeon to the king. And it was presented before the Salon. Those of you that were on the Impressionist tour, I talked a little bit about the Salon. And the Salon was sort of this governing body of the art world, governing really what art was and what was acceptable in the art form. And so we know that Oudry presented this portrait of the lion before the Salon and received rave reviews. Now, in terms of lions, it was sort of a staple animal for any menagerie, as lions, you can imagine, symbolize this idea of power and of courage. And also the lion being the king of the beast was very appropriate to have in one's menagerie. Now, something to bring this contemporary, if you were to try and look for this specific species of lion today, it's fully extinct in the wild. You would have to go to a zoo or some other institute conserving the reproduction of these creatures. This comes from the Atlas Mountains over in northwestern Africa. And lions were not an uncommon species in Europe, as they had been used even in the Roman period. If we think about the Colosseum, gladiatorial fights, and also during Christian martyr sessions in the early centuries AD. And yet they were a staple, as I mentioned, for the menageries. Now you'll notice on the side of this lion, there are the two leopards that we saw in the sketches in the previous gallery. And so here in front of these animals, I think it's very clear which is meant to be the male and which is meant to be the female, according to Udri. And we can make that out, right? So we can see the male is striking that very ferocious pose with his teeth glazing out before us, as if he's getting ready to either attack something or he's been frightened. I think it's beautiful the way the tail flips into the air. And then on the other side with the female, it's a very sensitive image. And yet with each of the animal portraits, I'd like to draw your attention to the eyes of the animal. Because oftentimes it's as if the animals are looking out at us, or as if they've been surprised by us or some other presence. So there is a sense that you can interact with the animals depicted. Also, you'll notice in all of the backgrounds, all of the animals would have been exhibited in pens in the menagerie. And yet here they're fully liberated out in the open. And something that I think is really spectacular about this suite of paintings is that the animals are shown life-size. And so Udri gives many of us a unique opportunity to get so close to these creatures that in the wild or in a zoo, we really wouldn't have the same experience. And so in their own day, they were meant as these sort of natural history components, this idea of studying the natural world and documenting it. But even today, we have that same opportunity to get close and to consider each of the movement of fur across the skin of this lion here, the claws on its paws, the mane as it rustles through the wind, the eyes, the fangs as they curl upward out of its mouth. Now, just by way of the menagerie, I'll mention that the more ferocious animals, like the lion and the leopard, came later. They weren't sort of the initial creatures to the menagerie. And so sort of the star of the exhibition is really this portrait of Clara. Again, a life-size image, as we saw in that copy in the first gallery. And so again, as I mentioned, this is a life-size portrait of Clara the rhinoceros. And again, Clara was not part of the menagerie itself. She had traveled, as I mentioned, all throughout Europe on this grand tour. And she arrived in Paris in the year 1749 with plenty of pomp and circumstance. And so you can see Udri here again depicting that creature that up until this point had not been seen by anyone in living memory in France or in Europe really at the time. Now, in terms of identifying the rhinoceros as an Indian rhinoceros, again, we can see the single horn. Clara has since regrown that horn that we saw it fell off in the Italian painting by the Circle of Longhi. But what's so interesting are these buttons on the backside of the animal here. And the flaps of skin, you can get an idea of why people in the age of Albrecht Dürer thought that these were armored creatures, literally wearing this sort of skin armor, very thick flaps of skin. And yet what's interesting in examining these creatures, if you were to run your hand behind those flaps of skin, it's very smooth. You can imagine the animal rubbing together as it moves, the skin flaps rubbing together, creating a very smooth undersurface. Also, something that was pointed out were her long toenails. They're somewhat unusual because if she were running free in the wild, the toenails would naturally be filed down. But because of her transport via carriage, they wouldn't have had that same opportunity to file down. You'll also notice on her skin are these white highlights. Udri is very interested in light and dark, these contrasts, the movement of light on the animal surface. But here it was proposed that these white markings are possibly rub marks as she's rubbing against her cage or maybe rubbing against her pen, leaving sort of the remnant there on her skin. There is that misconception that rhinos are these very armored creatures, and yet they're very sensitive. Their skin is very sensitive, and it would possibly have worn away in those areas from being transported all around. And we know that they may have used a sort of fish oil to soothe any wounds that may have developed or to massage her skin, a form of 18th century lotion. Now, what's also spectacular about this, again, is her eye. The way that she appears as if she sees us here. that we've walked into this room, and she's looking out to us. She acknowledges our presence. And yet, the ironic thing is that rhinos don't have the best vision. If we walked into this space right now and Clara were standing before us, she would have smelled us first. They have great sense of smell. And then she would have heard our movements. And so you can see her ears as they turn in all directions. So you can imagine Audrey observing Clara in Paris, and really her ears moving in all directions as there's all this pomp and circumstance around her arrival in the city. This great beast that many people had never seen. And so her ears, you can imagine, are constantly moving. Yeah, it is something spectacular. Even those that have seen a rhinoceros in the zoo, and I had the opportunity to actually touch the rhinoceros in the LA Zoo, it's still spectacular to see this very large-scale painting. And if we think back to painting at this time, painting of this scale would have been reserved for scenes from history, mythology, biblical scenes. And so it's spectacular that this rhinoceros takes such a prominent role in painting, or the size is so large. Now, something to mention, because as I said, Clara was not part of the menagerie. But when Vandermeer, the Dutch sea captain, brought her to Paris, the obvious person to present the rhino to was King Louis XV. And so he presented Clara to Louis and actually offered to sell her to the king. We can imagine the king was somewhat offended because many of the animals that were in the menagerie came as gifts to the throne. And so he doesn't end up purchasing Clara. But we do have this beautiful record of her by Audrey. So we could look at all of the paintings in this space, but I'd like to point out one other strange creature, and it's a bird, as the menagerie was initially intended for birds, to house, you know, exotic birds. And one of the strange birds is something that I'm not sure many of us here have seen. Has anyone seen this strange creature before? Or maybe something similar? It does look like an ostrich, maybe. An emu. And it does have a crest on its head. This is called a cassowary. And the cassowary comes from Indonesia or New Guinea. And so you can imagine Clara came from India, taking that long 7-month journey around Africa just to reach Europe. So imagine the journey that this bird would take all the way from Indonesia or New Guinea to reach France. So an amazing testimony to the labor that it would take to transport this creature. Now, the reason I present this creature is because it's one of the most dangerous birds alive. And it might not look too harmful right now, although I think, again, if we look at the eye of this creature, the cassowary, there is a sense of defiance, maybe, in the look, that he or she, as it may be, has noticed our presence in this space and is somewhat cautious of us, making sure that we know that he or she has seen us and is very aware of our presence. And yet what's interesting about this bird, if you look at these strange legs that were described by Audrey as looking sort of like an ostrich, as many of you have said, the middle toe there is razor sharp. The nail, the toenail there, is so sharp that if provoked, the creature can jump about its height, which is about 6 feet tall. It can jump a little where between 5 and 6 feet. And with that claw, can disembowel you if you provoke the creature. So again, I have to imagine what it would be like to transport this thing to Europe. And there were several comments about it at the time. Even Audrey had said that it could swallow anything, even burning coals. A very resilient creature. And it is a flightless bird. If you looked close, you'll notice where the wings would be, that are just suggested by these three prongs protruding from the side of the body. And so this is one of these creatures that looks very prehistoric in many ways, almost, you know, like a dinosaur. And so again, even in the background, you can see that Audrey has liberated the cassowary from its pen, as it would have certainly needed to be in the pen, as it was so dangerous. And he tries to suggest the home where this animal came, or the land that it came from, which was that sort of island paradise, at least in Audrey's mind, of Indonesia and New Guinea. This animal, the cassowary, can be seen in the Los Angeles Zoo. And probably one of the most spectacular things about this animal is the way it moves. And I would exemplify it for you here, but it would look rather strange. It's this constant bobbing motion of the head, and it has a strange squawking sound that it makes. So I think this animal would look rather frightening. It looks in some ways like a turkey with its, you know, these red gobbles hanging from its neck. And you had a very violent creature with that beautiful blue face and the crest of bone on its skull. At the Los Angeles Zoo, for example, they have very large fences, but up at the top they have to have electrified fences because at night you often have, you know, foxes and other small creatures that will try and go into the pen and then ultimately end up dead the next day because of this creature, how violent it is. So, somewhat interesting. There have been several comments about that bone on its head. At the Los Angeles Zoo, they commented that it would often use its head to scrape into the dirt to dig up insects. Maybe a more humorous example is that as it's reaching into a tree for fruit, it's to protect any soft spots on its head from, you know, falling fruit. I think that's a little bit more humorous. But it has a function to dig, you know, into the ground to dig up some insects. And I love that facial expression. I'm just really taken, even by what looks like an expression of anger or frustration, you know, or maybe desiring freedom, wanting to get out of that pen. Now, in terms of the overall layout of this room, the pen, the menagerie at Versailles, was laid out in a sort of octagonal fan shape. So in many ways, the way that you look at these paintings here is similar to how they may have been exhibited in the menagerie, in this sort of swooping fan octagonal motion across the room. Now, I'd like to look at one last painting of animals and then move into this discussion of how did these paintings that were created in France by a French artist end up in Germany, where ultimately they will return after the exhibitions here in the States. But before that, I'll just mention something about menageries in general and that idea that originally the menagerie was designed for birds, to house these exotic birds. And so here in this painting of the demoiselle crane, the toucan, and the tufted crane, you can see that the royalty really valued these birds, not only for their spectacular plumage, these beautiful feather patterns, and sort of the mating dances they would enter into, but if you look to the top of the tufted crane, that mount of beautiful gold feathers appears as if it's wearing a crown, a royal bird. Also, this demoiselle crane looks to be sort of like, you know, one of these very shy women at court with these beautiful swooping white feathers coming from the eye on its head. And these birds were prized for the dances that they entered into, their movement. And it's interesting that you have two birds from Africa, the demoiselle crane and the tufted crane. And in the center, you have the toucan coming from South America. So again, you can just imagine the breadth of creatures that are in this collection, really coming from all corners of the known world at the time. And so in some ways, I like the idea of thinking back to Louis XIV, who initially conceived of this menagerie with his architect, Levaux. And Louis called himself Le Roi Soleil, the Sun King. And the idea that at that time, the French Empire had grown so large that the sun would not set on the Empire of France. And you even get a sense of that, I think, here with these animals, ranging from Indonesia, New Guinea with the cassowary, to South America with the toucan, to Africa with the cranes and the lion, and all the way over into India with Clara herself. So there's a huge range, a spectrum of these animals in their homes. So again, this series of paintings, how does it get to Germany? Well, as I mentioned, La Pejoni dies before he pays for all of these paintings. And so like any good businessman, Oudry goes to really his favorite patron at the time, which was the Duke of Mecklenburg-Schwerin in Germany. And he sells this suite of paintings. He offers it to the Duke, stating that I have this suite of paintings that were created for His Majesty the King of France, and they were all created from life study, from real observation of these animals. And I would like to offer this suite of paintings to you for a far less price than I would have to His Majesty the King of France. So even in his wording, he's very diplomatic and businessman-like. And so we can see, just in the last space, which really is the opening of the exhibition, a portrait, this time done of a person by Oudry, and this is the Crown Prince Friedrich of Mecklenburg-Schwerin, done in the year 1739. And we know that the Crown Prince Friedrich had traveled to France, and his father, the Duke of Mecklenburg-Schwerin, desired for his son to have his portrait done by one of the great portraitists at the time. Now, he had originally desired for Rigaud to create the portrait. And there's a beautiful Rigaud portrait of Louis XIV in the Decorative Art Collection that I hope you'll all go to see. But I love the juxtaposition between this portrait of the Crown Prince, done by Oudry, and an entire suite of animal portraits done by the hand of Oudry. So you can understand why he was really praised for being this great animal portraitist. And I say animal portraitist because if you look at each of the animals again, he spends so much time defining not only, again, the plumage on the birds, the movement of the various animals, their musculature, the anatomy of them, but giving them a sense of personality, a sense of life, as if you could enter into a sort of conversation with them, if they could talk, if they could speak to us. And you can see here in the portrait of the Duke, as in the other portraits of the animals, he uses what is called a beau terminé, this very refined and glossy finish, building up the surface with these glazes. And so he sells a suite of paintings to the German court. And the reason why the German court would have wanted to purchase this is because at the time, many of the courts around Europe wanted to do everything à la française, or in the French way. Versailles and the palaces in France were sort of this example of what courtly life should be. And so we even briefly talked about that at the beginning with the porcelain rhinoceros of Augustus the Strong, Elector of Saxony, wanting to create a porcelain menagerie in a similar fashion to those menageries created in France. And so again, we've come back to really the start of the exhibition, and I hope that you now have the tools to go back and look at each of the paintings individually, to spend time with these animals, and I hope it gives some relevance for each of us today, that these are not some simple portraits of animals, but they really came from a labor on the part of Oudry, working first from his drawing practice, observing these animals in the flesh, and then finalizing with these beautiful oil paintings here today. And the final thing I'll say is that, again, it is a very unique opportunity to see them all here in the United States, as after they pass from here, they'll go to Houston and then back to Germany, to the hunting loft of the original Mecklenburg-Schwerin Dukes. So you would have to travel ultimately all the way over to Germany to see these paintings again. I hope that this has given you a great introduction, and if it's your first time at the Getty, welcome and enjoy the rest of your stay.